Cinema Faith Podcast for May 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the great Bambino, Mr. Tim Nelson.
I think that would be Babe Ruth's moniker, but all right, I'll take it.
I'm the great Bambino.
Sandlot?
No. Oh, see, I didn't even get the reference.
Oh, see, well. So here we are again, man. It's starting to feel a little bit like summer out there, which I like. We're in the Midwest, and we have had this roller coaster of weather up and down. Hate it. But yeah, it's starting to feel a little good. And you know what that means? Superhero movies are in full force in the box office, Tim Nelson. What the sigh? I don't understand the sigh.
What a great time to be on Netflix.
Oh, Tim, you stay may not...
Stay out of the air conditioner. Stay out of the dark. Go outside during the day.
One thing you may or may not know about Tim Nelson is he does not like superhero movies, which I don't understand. Tim, why must you kill puppies? They're so beautiful. What's wrong with superhero movies?
Because they're adolescent power fantasies, John.
Adolescent power fantasies.
Yeah. So they have their place when you're like, you know, when you're a young man.
All right. Well, because Tim is not fond of superhero movies, we did not see Captain America. That was the big superhero movie of the month, but I cannot force Tim to see it out of our friendship, but it would be kind of fun, though. I still want to get into a big fight with you one day. We're going to have this,
everyone's
like,
stopping
fight.
Me.
Yeah.
It is true.
It's going to be great. Like, we're just going to flip out, and it'll be like mic drop and fuzz, and they'll wonder, did they reconcile? Are they even coming back? Who knows? So one day. No. Stay tuned for the fight. But anyway, no, we did not watch a superhero movie. But still, I will say this about superhero movies to defend my friend here is that one regret I have about how just Marvel sort of took over everything is there used to be this kind of a movie back in the day where you had it was like an action movie for adults. It was like a staple of the summer. I think the best example I could come up with is The Rock with Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery, right? You had this type of movie where it's just strictly for adults. There's explosions. It's funny. You have kind of characters bantering off each other. That used to be kind of what the summer was all about. And then it's shifted into this superhero movie thing, which is kind of, you know, broader, more for everyone. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just I kind of miss those days. And that's why I was excited that we could catch a movie that's kind of in that vein, which is The Nice Guys with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe. And that is what we are going to be discussing today. Because to me, this is like the perfect summer movie.
I thought we were going to talk about Armageddon.
No, that's next. Oh, no.
When do we talk about movies? When do we talk about movies where they drill into asteroids to save the Earth?
I liked Armageddon. Stop it. But yeah, you know, this is like the perfect summer movie. It's breezy, it's smart, and it's fun. So that's what we watched, and we're ready to talk about it. So this is The Nice Guys. So as usual, before we get to the nuts and bolts of the film, we like to kind of pull the curtain back and talk about who made the movie and what his story is. So The Nice Guys is written and directed by a dude named Shane Black. And before Shane was a director, he was a writer. And he was like a hotshot writer. This guy sold the Lethal Weapon screenplay. That's right. The Lethal Weapon with Mel Gibson, Danny Glover. Sold that at like 22, age 22.
Not Lethal Weapon 4.
No, he did not write any of
the Lethal Weapon script.
The Lethal Weapon script. What were you doing at 22, Tim? Were you selling screenplays to Hollywood?
No, I couldn't read.
Awesome.
No, I was not.
No. So this guy was like on fire. And yeah, Lethal Weapon, you know, I've actually got a confession. I watched Lethal Weapon for the very first time 3 days ago, actually. I just never got around to it. I don't know why. It's one of those series that I always heard about but never got around to. What do you think of Lethal Weapon, Tim?
So it's a classic film.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in 20 years.
20 years, okay.
Yeah. So I can't really help you there. Last time I saw it, I was a teenager.
Sure.
And so I don't really have a ton of – I don't remember a ton about it.
Well, it's very 80s. I mean, there's no question. It's got 80s vibe all the way through.
There's mullets in it, right?
Yes, yeah. Mullets. But it's good. I mean, and it really is good because of Mel Gibson. That guy, I mean, legitimately, Mel Gibson is and was a great actor, and he makes that movie single-handedly. It's just, it plays this, like, suicidal cop, literally, because he's, like, grieving over his wife and yeah. just live wire. You don't know what he's going to do. Teaming up with Danny Glover, who's kind of, like, straight-laced, and, yeah, he makes it. So, Mel Gibson. What happened to Mel Gibson?
That's like three podcasts, man. We can't yes. do that right now.
All right. We'll save that for another day. But anyway, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but that's a pretty amazing feat, like what you're saying.
Yeah.
That somebody could write that screenplay at such a young age.
Totally.
And yeah, so I'm very impressed with that.
But he topped it. Well, probably not in quality, but in money, because he also wrote this script for The Long Kiss Goodnight, which I've not seen. It stars Samuel L. Jackson. But the kicker there was that at that time, it was the highest selling screenplay ever. For like $4 million he sold the screenplay for, which is outrageous. I mean, like, if you're a screenwriter, good money is $100,000, a couple hundred
right,
thousand.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely.
$4 million. And it totally, like, backfired on him, because all of his screenwriting friends were just like, dude, like, really? And he lost a lot of friends, he said, during that process. And he sort of started, like, thinking introspectively, like, am I just a formula writer? You know, am I making just garbage? Like, just am I just in it for the money? And the dude, like, disappeared from Hollywood for 5 years, just gone.
So he's kind of in the desert of his kind of his writing career.
Yeah.
Except he's in the desert with $4 million.
With $4 million, yeah, okay. Which you can't feel
which
too bad
for. Which is kind
of
him. A pretty nice desert. There's like yeah, pools yeah. and like whatever
there,
you
there
want.
There were probably water in that desert.
Cocaine in the desert?
Yeah. I think so. But so he disappears, and then he comes back, and not just as a writer this time, but as a writer-director with the movie Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is a great title.
Yeah. Title. Do you know what that title's that. About?
No.
So I found this out recently.
Okay.
So Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is slang in Europe for any spy kind of movie.
Really?
Or I'm sorry, any detective movie. I mean, not spy movie. Yeah.
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 Makes sense.
So that's kind of interesting, huh?
It is. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Yeah. And Robert Downey Jr. is in this and Val Kilmer, which, it was kind of an unlikely duo. But this was a part of Robert Downey Jr.'s big comeback, you know, because he also had this big period where, due to addiction issues, he was out of it and kind of blacklisted from Hollywood like Mel Gibson, and still is. And this was a part of his comeback, which culminated with Iron Man. So Robert Downey Jr. is really good in this. And did you rewatch this one?
Yeah, I rewatched it. Okay. And yeah, he's excellent.
He is.
It's legitimately. It's probably my favorite role I've ever seen him in.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
He seems like he's made to play that part of the, where he's like always questioning himself, mm-hmm. and he's unsure of who he is morally.
Yeah. It was really refreshing when I rewatched it too to see his vulnerability, because, you know, I'm so used to him in Iron Man where he's just like the smartest guy in the room and rat-a-tat like dialogue and knows everything. But this, he was very like insecure in this movie, which is cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Like, I think he writes insecure male leads, which to me is very attractive because I'm in.
You don't have it all together, really?
Well, I know. Oh, it's shoot. Weird, right?
Okay.
But I think that's actually a very, like, I thought of this movie as being a very male voice.
Mm-hmm.
And of
for
course,
sure.
like, not just, I think people tend to go, oh, it's super violent, so it's male. And I think that's that's wrong.
Yeah.
I think it's male because you have a character who is insecure and who's trying out kind of masculinity, right? And so I really dig that kind of vulnerable male character, mm-hmm. instead of something that's just a canned version of masculinity.
It's how males really are. We're insecure at heart. Yeah,
right,
for sure.
Right, absolutely.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, genuinely funny movie. I, you know, it's rare that I will genuinely laugh out loud at a film, and I remember as I was rewatching this like 6 times, like could not stop laughing, and it's because of the dialogue, not just because like slapstick or like a sight gag or something, but like it's just really clever writing.
So I know last time we were talking about Richard Linklater writing realistic dialogue.
Yep.
This would not be that.
Correct.
This would
yes.
be like super thoughtful. In fact, I was listening to NPR. There was a just a really brief thing on NPR about this film,
mm-hmm.
and it was talking about how he writes a dialogue. And he writes scenes, and he basically writes a whole bunch of scenes just to get one scene. So it takes him like a script. It's going to take him, you know, I don't know how many scenes are in a script, but he's going to write 3, 4, 5, 6 times as many scenes.
And distill it into one.
And distill it into one thing.
Okay.
So, like, it is exactly what you're talking about, which is the opposite of the Linklater approach, which would be, like, it has to be witty, which, but that's...
There's a place for that.
There is. And it's within his own, the tradition, which we'll talk more about later.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned laughing out loud. Shane Black definitely specializes in kind of black comedy, I guess would be the is that the phrase for it?
Yeah,
kind of
sure,
dark comedy.
Sure, dark comedy,
this isn't like Princess Bride or like a Will Ferrell movie. Like it's kind of it takes place always in the criminal underbelly, if you will, kind of unsavory characters, sort of like Tarantino, I guess, but different.
So it's funny that you mentioned Princess Bride because one of his major writing influences is the guy that wrote The Princess Bride.
No way.
Yeah.
See.
Yeah.
All right.
And there are elements of dark comedy with a Christopher Guest character.
That's
and,
true. I rewatched that recently too, and I was like with my 8-year-old son, and I'm like, goodness sakes.
He's like torturing this man to death and he's like taking life off of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, right?
Tell me, how do you feel? Like that. Yeah. But yeah, so it's definitely dark comedy. It's not everybody's cup of tea, sort of like a Quentin Tarantino movie. I mean, this isn't a movie that's going to appeal to the masses. But if you like that sort of thing, it really is funny and it's clever. And if you think back to Lethal Weapon, which I know it's been a long time, but Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, there's definitely a little bit of a loose formula at work in what he's doing here. And it's kind of like two guys that team up, and one of them, for some reason, is a wild card. You're not sure what you're going to get. And in like Robert Downey Jr.'s case, he's inexperienced. He's not used to this world. In Mel Gibson's case, it's because he's suicidal. And then there's one guy that's kind of like a professional, kind of more straight-laced, more like...
They're professionals, but they're also like outsiders. So mm-hmm. I look at the characters like Danny Glover is your straight laced one,
right?
But they're also kind of outsiders, right?
Yeah.
And then I look at Val Kilmer, who plays a gay man who's like on the outs. Like everyone's
That's
like,
true.
They call, what's his name?
Gay Perry.
Gay Perry. Everyone identifies him as gay is before they identify him as anything else.
Hmm.
And then I look at the character of Russell Crowe, and he's basically kind of isolated. And he's on the out too, and he's
on the
like
fringes.
He's breaking people's arms for $27,
taking like schoolgirls' monies to go
for
do
like
this.
He's like he just isn't running his business very well.
No.
And he is on the outside, and he does things. Sometimes he does things right, but a lot of times he doesn't. So I think that there is a element of like there is a very obviously broken character, and there's mm-hmm. another character that is broken, but it's not quite as obvious in the beginning, or who's an outsider, maybe not broken.
Yeah, well, let's get to that, into the heart of the nice guys. So, like you said, basically, you have another sort of buddy comedy situation with Russell Crowe being, like Tim said, this guy who basically taking people's money to go send a message physically, like, you know, go tell this guy to stop following me, and he'll go into the guy's house and break his arm, and that's basically Russell Crowe's character. He's kind of on the outside of the law, I guess you could say, or in the gray area maybe. But and then you have Ryan Gosling, who plays this detective, quote unquote, which is really just he's totally in it to scam people out of their money and take cases that, you know, the person's already dead and he knows that up front and he can just milk the check, or to string the client along and just get the next installment. That's all he's about. So you have these two Russell Crowe,
they're not nice guys.
They're not nice guys. No, that's for sure. Russell Crowe is the one who's good at his job, I guess you could say, out of the two. But, so they end up teaming up because there's this... See, this is where the plot is just insane. So, like, and this is kind of a tradition in his movies, too, with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and even Lethal Weapon to an extent. You just have kind of a ridiculous plot that makes, if you really stop and think about it, makes no sense and is very hard to explain. I mean, this is basically about there's someone missing, like a porn star's missing named Amelia, and, somehow the Detroit Auto Company is involved in this, and there's like this massive conspiracy. I don't know. I honestly don't know how to explain it.
Summary online takes four paragraphs to summarize like the basic plot.
Right. But it's not the point. The plot isn't the point. The plot is just an excuse to get these characters to go to all kinds of weird places and meet all kinds of weird people. That's all the plot is. It's like it's this massive conspiracy involving like 50 people so that they can go meet all these people and have witty banter among them. That's really what it is. And so I can't describe the plot if you press me, but it
go online. You can find it online.
You can find it. But Shane Black really likes this detective stories, kind of this old noir type film, and right, Tim, sort yeah, of follow
so,
that
so,
vein.
So like one of the, yeah, so it is, he's like in a noir, he's really inspired by novels that were written in the 30s and 40s, and I think there's a bunch of different elements of that. Like, I think the first thing that film buffs notice is that there's dark and light, and you'll notice like in a lot of the scenes that you have one side of their face will be dark and one side will be light, which is actually very intentional.
Yes.
And the reason for that is basically it's a symbol of the characters, is that they're dark and they're light, so they're evil and they're good. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the characteristics, and you actually see that in all these different scenes, is you'll have heavy lighting on one side of their face, and then on the other side it won't be. It'll be very dark. And we were talking about a bunch of different films. I guess Rodriguez does that too. Anyway, no, it's not. It's who did Sin City?
I can't remember. I'm blanking now on that. Sorry.
Anyway, there's a lot of people that do that. But so the genre itself, like, you know, is really known for being in the mid 40s to the late 50s.
Mm-hmm. What are some classics of the noir genre?
So like Maltese Falcon is one that would everyone. There's like several Bogart ones, but there's 300 of them that are kind of cataloged as considered the classic era of film noir. And there's like neo noir, which would be like say Chinatown with Jack Nicholson. Yep. You've probably seen that.
Yeah. And, I'm actually in the minority. I think it's a little bit overrated, but it's okay.
What?
I know. Don't okay, give me that. Right. We'll save that for another day.
All right. Fair enough. So there's neo-noir, and then there's also filmmakers that employ it now. Big Lebowski would actually be loosely based. I think we talked about this when we talked about Coen Brothers.
That would be classified as noir.
Some people would classify it that way.
Okay.
But it is based on Murder, My Sweet, which is another classic one. Mm-hmm. And so there's quite a few of them. Sunset Boulevard is a film noir. It's told from the perspective of someone who's dead. Mm. But some of the other things are that they tend to be narrated by the main character.
Yes. And the narration is very clever in all of Shane Black's movies, which mm-hmm. I like. Because the typical narration gets so boring, but like he always has a spin on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a femme fatale, like within noir. So if you're not familiar with this genre, you probably are and you just don't realize you are.
Right.
So there's always some kind of super attractive woman that the protagonist is incapable of resisting mm-hmm. who will actually become the death of that protagonist.
That's in all of them, yeah.
That's in all of those. It goes all the way back to Greek, kind of Greek mythology, but that's one of the elements of it. They also would say that a plot line that has tons of flashbacks and that's very complicated, like overly complicated, is also part of it.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So it's like very clearly within that vein. So the thing that I found really interesting when I was looking a little bit about film noir was, I know I'm going on here, but
no, it's good.
I thought this was helpful, was that I guess it really gained popularity in post-World War II when GIs were returning from war and they had done some maybe horrible things and they were looking for heroes they could relate to. Hmm. And so you look at these characters and one of the things that you see is like they're not good guys, but they're a little bit better than the bad guys.
The main characters in the films.
The protagonists. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So one of the things I was reading was saying that they didn't like... To be a good guy in a film noir, all you have to do is like not murder or rape anyone.
That's a pretty low bar.
Right. To be honest. Exactly. Yeah. And you're like, oh my gosh, really? That's it? That's the moral. But I think that you needed a new kind of hero because the old hero, like you couldn't, these guys had been through a lot and had done some things that they probably weren't proud of.
Gotcha.
And they needed a new hero.
Yeah.
And so the film noir genre allows them to have a new hero. So that Humphrey Bogart, who might, you know, in some of these movies, who might be kind of morally ambiguous, uh-huh. for them could still be a hero. Wow, and in fact, they might actually relate more to that hero. So I'm not surprised that film noir plays today because I think we're that way too, right?
Absolutely.
So we're probably relate better to these characters than we would to some kind of valiant knight on a horseback who'd never done anything wrong.
Well, not to mention we're in kind of the age of the anti-hero too, you know, I mean, like mm-hmm. right and left with Breaking Bad and everything. It's like we love that. I think
we do. And so yeah, absolutely. You're mm-hmm. like, really, Walter? You can wear a t-shirt with that guy? Okay.
So, really well-acted film. Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling, I mean, just totally nail it. I mean, these are two, like, premier actors. We know this. But it's so fun seeing them together, so fun playing off each other. And Ryan Gosling's always been one of my favorite actors since even The Notebook, which I will stand by. Classic romantic film.
I have attempted to screen it twice, and I fell asleep both times.
I think it is a truly, genuinely touching film, and the ending has, and it will make me cry. I think it's a sweet movie. And Ryan Gosling's really good in it. He brings authenticity to that role. He grounds it, because it could be very cheesy, and I think he's the one who makes it. Not that
so The Notebook, okay.
Yeah, The Notebook. Anyway, and lots of movies. But, I mean, he really hit his stride with Drive. Did you see Drive? Mm-hmm. You need to watch Drive. That's really good. It's he plays like a superhero, quote-unquote, but...
I haven't watched it.
It's really good. Half Nelson, where he was this teacher in an inner city. Oh, my... Okay, we're having a like a Ryan Gosling
I'm
marathon.
I'm okay with that. I'm not...
Lars and the Real Girl.
Lars and the Real Girl, yes, absolutely.
Lars and the Real Girl. Blue Valentine with... Oh, man, so good.
I'm ill-prepared, apparently.
That's okay. It's all good. Anyway, we're not going to spend much time talking about it, but I just, he's one of my favorite actors. And then Russell Crowe, who admittedly, lately, has not been in a ton. He's had kind of a dry spell, but back in the day, this was Gladiator, man. I mean, he was on top of the world back then, and he's Cinderella Man, right? Beautiful Mind, I believe
he won
an Oscar. Right? There was a stretch there where he was really...
He was the leading man of Hollywood for a while.
And he's a solid actor. And so both of these guys together, it's magic. It's really cool. And so, yeah, what did you think about them just as actors and coming together?
So I don't have a... Like you can tell, I don't have a background in Gosling. I mean, I know some stuff.
It's okay.
I thought he's all right. It's hard because I watched Kiss Kiss Bang Bang like within probably 24 hours of watching this one. So it's hard because I got to see, or was it Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And I thought he was so excellent that he kind of eclipsed all my Ryan Gosling ideas.
I don't know. I think Gosling is right on par with him. I think he's the best thing about the movie. I would.
So you think he's better than... What's the young girl? I thought she was the best.
Well, of course. Yes.
We'll get to her.
We'll get to her. Okay. Yeah. But I don't know. I think Gosling even overshadowed Russell Crowe a little bit, but that's okay. No, go ahead.
So my thoughts on Russell Crowe is he's known to be hard to work with.
Uh-huh. I believe that.
And he's just a difficult guy to work with. In fact, there's even comedy sketches about that.
Oh, no.
he's just very contentious, apparently.
Okay.
And so I know that's the case. I know it's hard because he's getting older and he isn't like as in shape as he used to be and stuff like that. So it's harder to get the roles.
Perfect for that character. But
yeah, he was good for that character. Mm-hmm. Kind of. He's beginning to enter into his like Mickey Rourke stage.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Right. Like, yeah, at least he had a comeback.
He was a boxer in his prime, you know?
Right.
And you're like, yeah, I can believe he was a boxer in his prime. Right. I don't know where he is now. But I kind of like that because it means he has to add some complexity to the character. Mm-hmm. I didn't find Crowe's character overly complex.
Yeah, I didn't think so either.
Like I didn't like wonder, oh, what happened to him?
Mm-hmm.
They don't really get into that. They don't even beg that question.
They shade a little bit more depth to, I think, Gosling than Crowe in that one, but Shane Black. But yeah, so but it's still fun seeing them solve this mystery that is just so ridiculous, and they just have really good comic timing with it. There's some slapstick elements involved here, right, where I think Ryan Gosling is so funny in so many parts just because he's totally out of his element, and how many times does he just stumble upon the next clue, you know, literally like rolling down a hill and there's this body or whatever, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah, there's nothing. Yeah. There's the idea of intentionality.
Uh-huh.
Like within that film, it's like, no, it's like everything he does, even when it seems like he's like hype, like super intentional, he's like Sherlock Holmes-ish, he's actually not.
Right. No, not at all.
And he's totally, like sometimes you go, wow, how do you know that? And you're like, no, he was wrong. He was totally wrong.
Yeah.
And so I like that character because that is...
Me too. It goes back to the insecure male.
Well, yeah, it's nice to have like the insecure male who's not Clint Eastwood, who overtly fails all the time. And then... who has some skills. He does have some skills, but who you should clearly not hire as your detective.
Yeah, right.
Which I think is good.
So,
Well, I was reading somewhere that he actually is based, both the Robert Downey Jr. character from the Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and then also his character are based on a guy who was a private detective.
Really?
Yeah.
A real life dude. Okay.
A real life guy who was a former Marine that did a bunch of detective work.
Wow.
Yeah. And anyway, there was this funny story I was reading about, and it was saying that like where he says, "You're the worst detective in the whole world." The daughter tells him that.
Yeah.
Was actually told to that guy because he was investigating some lady for, he was investigating some lady for adultery and ended up sleeping with her in real life.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then his sister was like, "You're the worst detective in the whole world."
That's a good story. And it's in the movie. There you go.
Yeah. So apparently he tells a bunch of stories and those have been incorporated into those characters, which I think is it's always nice to know there might be some reality because it seems real. And
yeah,
like,
it does.
Where did this come from?
Right.
And so it did come from some real stories.
So one bone to pick that I have with Shane Black, and you may agree or disagree with this, is the way that women are portrayed in his movies. So he basically, the thing about it is that he goes out of his way at times to really affirm the dignity of women, right? So in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, there's that moment where Robert Downey Jr. is like, the spider is like crawling on her as she's sleeping and it goes under her shirt and he's trying to like kill the spider and mm-hmm. she wakes up and he's like groping her and she's like, you know, stop, what are you doing? And then he's like, no, there's a spider. And she's like, uh-huh, whatever, it's okay, just admit you were like, you know, trying to touch me and stuff. And he's like, no, this is important, like, that's not cool, I wouldn't do that, and B, you shouldn't be just like okay with guys doing that, right? Like, he gets very adamant. And in The Nice Guys, it opens with this kid who's like gawking at this, you know, woman in a magazine that he's stolen from his like parents' stash or something. And then the same exact actress in that magazine that he's looking at, suddenly he encounters her in a life or death situation and she's exposed and he covers her up, you know, and it's kind of like this dignity of women. But then on the other stretch, Shane Black has no problem objectifying women. Like, I mean, he has no problem with nudity, and he picks beautiful women, so you can't have your cake and eat it too, right? You can't say, yeah, you know, guys shouldn't be pigs, and then present women as objects. To me, yeah.
So the plot, yeah, so it's kind of interesting plot. I mean, if you look at the plot, there's some very feminist elements, especially to this one more than Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes.
So, like, if the big plot is that the daughter of the really the head of the Justice Department, who is like a very powerful career woman mm-hmm. in the 70s, kind of exemplifies the liberated woman, right?
Yeah,
is like the ultimate bad guy, and the way that you unseat her is to make a porno.
That's the big plan
from
her daughter.
So that's her daughter's plan. And then she says, oh, that's just the market. She's like, oh, the porno part's just the markability part.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
They're going to expose the injustice within this porno movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have this character that's like basically an environmental. She's environmental and she's using her sexuality in order to fight her own mother.
Yeah.
Who has basically risen to the top and she's ultra corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's basically being controlled by the big three, which is I'm assuming is like controlled by men, the auto industry.
Right.
So she's a woman who appears to be strong, but is being controlled by men to enact unjust policies. And so the way she's going to unseat her is by making a porno that reveals these unjust policies. Right.
I mean, is that what it is? Right. This is what I'm saying.
And then what's funny is then that woman gets undone by, basically that plot gets undone by a 12-year-old girl.
which is the good element, because you're right. In The Nice Guys, the positive element comes out strongly because, I mean, seriously, who is the smartest, most beautiful woman in The Nice Guys is this, like, 12-year-old girl. Like, absolutely, hands down.
Right. So that's, and I love the hype, the contrast between a real person who is loved and who is struggling with loss, and who's a girl, 12-year-old girl,
mm-hmm.
Who is the daughter of someone too. That contrast when she goes into the basically a party full of porn stars.
Yeah,
the contrast of that to me is really powerful. So, like, my take on it would be different than yours.
Okay,
my take would be that when you contrast those things, the brilliance of that girl really is like contrasted with the vacuousness of the pornography actresses and basically pornography pimps. And so to me, like, I think that contrast is intentional. I think that was there for a reason, like that you'd have. Yeah, I really do.
Well, you're right. I mean, she's beautiful, not because she's revealing anything. This is a girl for crying out loud, and she's wearing overalls. But, like, she's beautiful because her character's on display, right? As compared to these women who, right.
She's seeking the truth, her motivation is not financial.
Mm-hmm.
Her motivation is she wants to get the bad guy. So she actually, what's funny is, yeah, and we've talked about the title, the nice guys, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that these guys aren't, they're not nice.
They're not.
And, but she wants them to be. In fact, she even asked her, what does her dad ask her? Am I a good guy? She's like, no, what does he say?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, she asks her dad, are you a good, no, he asks her.
Yeah,
he's like, am I a good guy? And she's like, no.
He's like, don't lie to me. Tell me the truth. He's like, no, you're not a good guy.
And then she pulls away. She's like driving the car.
Yeah. And then she has,
go ahead.
Well, I was thinking with the Russell Crowe figure.
Yeah.
Like she has also this idea that, well, if her father isn't, maybe this guy is. And mm-hmm. so she's watching him really closely, and he ends up like murdering somebody. And she asks him, "Did you kill that guy?" Because she kind of knows he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "Of course not," but he really did.
Well, I remember after the movie we talked about, and I was saying she's like the moral center of the movie, and I remember you said she's looking for a moral center.
Yeah,
I thought that was really profound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she wants. So the Gosling character is always remarking about how they, and I think also. Russell Crowe's character remarking how the kids are all crappy and corrupt. This generation of kids, they've got no morality, and they're a bunch of chets, which is Chet's one of the protesters who's kind of like, I don't know, he's
kind
of
stoner kid,
kind of airheaded.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just saying these kids are terrible, and there's another kid that just doesn't seem to have anything together.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, you know, what's wrong with this generation? Yeah, at the same time, the daughter is very morally centered, and she is looking for... She's looking for good guys.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she's looking for. And so she's testing out her own father. She knows he's not. And then she's testing out Crowe. And so the process of this movie, and you know I love character development.
Yes.
The movie is them going from bad guys to good guys.
To nice guys.
Or nice guys. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So
they go from being bad guys to nice guys. And you see that most... clearly with the Crowe character when he refuses when she asks him not to kill the guy that was trying to, the hitman.
Yes.
And he says, okay, I won't.
This is important, and I want to get to this too, because so violence is definitely a part of Shane Black's movies, but something very interesting happens in The Nice Guys, as you're alluding to. So the daughter, Holly, is running with another character away from this really, you know, nasty villain. And they're being chased. This guy wants to kill them. He will kill them if he catches them. So they're running across the highway, and the villain gets, not the villain, but one of them, not spoiling anything, but one of the villains gets hit by a semi-truck or something. And so he's lying on the pavement, just like in bleeding, mm-hmm. like totally incapacitated. She, Holly, this Ryan Gosling's daughter, stops running and turns back and says, hey, this guy needs help. We need to get him some help, you know? And the other character she's with is like, what are you talking about? Let's keep running. And she's like, no, we need to help him. And that is so interesting to me, because it's something you like never see in a Hollywood movie, because it's so assumed. This whole like, you know, myth of redemptive violence is just so ingrained in Hollywood. It's like, you know, obviously if you have the bad guy in your crosshairs, you got to kill him, you got to end it. But like this idea of loving your enemies is so rare, and it was so like profound in this scene that it just blew me away. And it reminded me of this story that I read. I don't remember the details or the characters, the names or anything, but like there was a story about the Anabaptists, because I was reading about the Anabaptist tradition, and there's one story about how this someone was chasing an Anabaptist because he was convinced that person was a heretic and needed to be like burned or executed or something for heresy. And so he's chasing him through this field or whatever, and the persecutor falls into a pit, and the Anabaptist turns around and turns back and drags him out of the pit, saves his life, and then the persecutor guy ends up continuing right on forward as if it didn't happen, or arrests him and then kills him. And so this guy died basically loving his enemy. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's so Jesus. And it reminds me of, I wrote this article, I don't know if you had a chance to read it, it was about Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Is Indiana Jones a hero? And there were basically like three qualifications I had for being a hero. The first one was, heroes are, I was just like reflecting on this whole question, is Indiana Jones a hero? And he's just, you know, basically concluded that he's not. He's just another kind of American cowboy. He's mowing people down for treasure, for the ones he loves. He's that typical in that vein. And so the three qualifications I came up with were, first, heroes are servants, heroes are peacemakers, and heroes are anonymous. And Holly fits these three categories. She is a hero. First of all, she's humble. She's not afraid to give her dad credit. You know, she basically solves the whole entire crime.
Yeah,
and she and but she lets her dad have the glory. And she is a peacemaker, like we just talked about, willing to she wants to stop evil, but she's also not going to kill to do it. And she's anonymous in that she is like that little person, like you were saying, that no one would think anything of. Everybody discards. Like, the whole time Ryan Gosling's like, go to Jessica's house, get out
of
here.
Go to Jessica's house.
You know,
yeah.
Basically. And then there she is, always in the center of the action, like solving the whole crime. So to me,
and confronting evil better than those guys, than the nice guys are.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh. So Indiana Jones didn't make the cut for a hero for me, but if you want a modern day example of a hero in a movie, it's Holly.
You know what it reminded me of? True Grit.
Yes.
Like, so in both True Grits, so the original with John Wayne and then also the more recent
I saw them
on
a recent one. Yeah.
So it reminded me of True Grit because the idea is, who has the True Grit? Is it the, you know, is it the John Wayne character, or mm-hmm. is it the young girl? And I think that that really works.
Yeah.
Like, it really works.
That contrast works.
So I thought she was a very well-written character, and she acted well, too.
She did.
So I could see more roles for her. Yeah, but I think that's what they wanted to do, was show that, like this child could transform the grown men. So I always am
by
like...
By example, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, by example, and then by... yeah, and that she's looking, she's always asking him, yeah, you know, she's expecting more of them than what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, you know, I think about that as like, you know, as a parent. Or,
is that what sanctification is? You know what I'm saying? Like, Jesus pulling us along and mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But I do know, like, yeah, it is like flips on its head, like where we're just like, teach our kids the moral values, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then she's very moral.
Yeah.
And she's also deeply moved. So she's always on the hill where her house burned down.
Yes.
And it's implied, it doesn't say, but it's implied that her mom died there, or that something bad happened afterwards. And so she's always there. And the idea is that she deeply grieves, she deeply mm-hmm. feels, because mm-hmm. her dad's numbing out all the time, right?
Right.
And she's like more real than any of the other characters.
She is. Mm-hmm. She's the best character in the film. There's no mm-hmm. question.
Yeah.
So, Tim, go ahead. Overall impressions of the movie. Just sum up your thoughts on the film.
I think that Shane Black is a unique voice in his writing, and I would definitely go and see another one of his movies.
Absolutely.
It was good. It's not like going to make my, you know, top five lists of the year, probably. Mm-hmm. But I think we need more of that, where he's based in a traditional genre, but he's playing with it a little bit and having fun. And then the writing is just very funny, and I appreciate dark humor. So I would say, I don't know, do we have a system?
I have a letter grade system, which I hold to dearly, but there are many other people who don't like it. And
okay,
so come up with your own system.
If I give a letter grade, I would give it a B, solid B, B plus.
Perfect.
Is that fair?
That's totally fair, and that's exactly my letter grade. I would say a solid B, and if I was feeling generous, a B+. Yeah, the movie's a blast. There's no question. It's totally fun. It's summer fun. The leads are awesome, engaging. It's genuinely funny, so well written. The plot's ridiculous, though. I mean, there's no question, and to me, that automatically bumps it down.
It's part of the form, dude.
I get it, but I'm not going to give a movie an A that, like, I can't even explain the plot.
So, but you could say the same thing for Sunset Boulevard or for China. Town, which you didn't, but you didn't like Chinatown either.
That's what I'm saying.
So, but I would say that's actually part of the you. If you ditch out on that part, mm-hmm. you've basically turned your back on the genre.
Well,
so I'm disagreeing with you here.
All right, that's fine. That's totally fine. But yeah, I'd say overall, if you're down with these kind of movies, which is sort of in the realm of Tarantino, but a lighter version, a more witty, comic version of Tarantino, then definitely give this one a watch. You can wait probably for DVD, but hey, if you want a counterpunch to Captain America and superhero movies, it's playing in theaters right now for you. There you go.
I would suggest it above.
Absolutely.
That's me, because I just hate Captain
I would
America
say it's the best
reason.
Movie playing right now. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
And we love the character of Holly and those little flashes of truth. So, yeah, overall, it was fun. Nice change of pace. I would give it, like yourself, a solid B, maybe a B+, if I was feeling really good. But that's it, man. That's Shane Black. That's the nice guys. And I must say, Black has a little bit of a nerd quality to him because he actually has directed a total of 3 films. We talked about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys, but he also did Iron Man 3, which I liked. And he not only directed, he wrote and directed it. I thought it was a solid entry in the franchise.
Which makes me want to see a superhero film.
See, you should watch. He wrote and directed it, man. Come on.
He made $1 billion. Yeah. $1 billion. $1 billion. Yes. So now he can do whatever he wants.
He can.
He can make these cool films like probably better than Iron Man 3. Uh-huh. But I honestly haven't seen Iron Man 3. Is it good?
You should. It's really good. But again, it's coming from someone who likes superhero movies, so you know your results may vary. But okay. I thought it was a good movie.
Fair
and
enough.
The next movie of his currently in the works is not another noir film, but in fact a remake of Predator.
So this might be on the cutting room floor here. But there is a character within Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Is it Kiss Kiss Bang Bang where there's like the Protocop?
Protocop. What do you mean by that?
It's like the guy that dresses up as the RoboCop, basically, and like breaks into the... I don't remember this part.
Are you sure it was in that?
He does a lot of referential, like quotes where you're referencing things, and he's talking about...
It's a flashback with a Michelle Monaghan's character where she like beats up this robot that's in her house randomly. Okay,
right.
Got you.
That happens too, but there's a line that refers to it. It says he even acted in one of those horrible movies, and it's actually referencing, because he acted in Predator. Wasn't he in Predator?
Yeah, maybe he was.
I think he was actually acting in Predator, and he's talking about it as a terrible movie, but now he's like, now he's highly involved in this next one.
Yeah, he was. I don't remember what character he was, but he was one of the first characters who dies in the original Predator. Shane Black,
right.
We're talking about. Shane Black was one of the... So anyway, there you go. Remake of Predator. That's the next one in the works. So, but hey, there is a slight chance for a Nice Guy sequel. I mean, if you think about the end of the movie, they leave the door ajar, and the official word is it's not in the works for sure, but it doesn't sound like he's opposed to it, so that would be cool.
So last time I checked the internet, it had a $50 million budget.
$50 million.
It had only brought in 15.
Oh. Never mind about that sequel.
But it's only been out for 5 days.
That's true. So. But I'm hoping for it. And yeah, so hey, that's the Nice Guys. Tim, great talking to you as always. And thanks for listening, everybody. And everybody, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.